Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, here with co-host Steve Romanen, who's also teching for us today. We have a pretty exciting show coming up. We're going to be talking about Prop B, which is the puppy mill cruelty prevention act that is currently being hotly debated in Missouri and beyond. And so we're going to be talking with a representative from the Humane Society of the United States. Steve did all the legwork for this interview, so a big thank you to him. I wanted to say another set of thank yous to everybody who donated during the fall fundraising drive. We had a very successful drive overall with the station, and with Animal Voices, we came in well above our quota, and that is wonderful because it does send a very strong message to CIUT that there is listener support behind the program. So we really wanted to thank everybody a lot for your donations. There was a few people that we didn't get a chance to thank on air, and so I wanted to take a moment to thank them. We have David Cunningham. Thank you very much for your donation. Gudrun Hines, you're always so generous, and we really appreciate it. We also have Bob Tinmans, who donated, and Joseph Stadler, or Josef Stadler. So thank you to all of those folks as well, and sorry that we didn't get a chance to thank you last week. We are going to be sending out special gifts. Hopefully you're all in Toronto or can give away the gifts to somebody in Toronto, because there is the second location of Urban Herbivore that is now opening, and Stephen Gardner is very generously given us the dinner for two, which was the draw for last week, and that went to Gary Petschke. And he's also going to give some other free goodies away through Urban Herbivore, and everybody that we didn't get a chance to thank last week will get something from that establishment. So thanks again to everybody for donating. It was really wonderful, very heartwarming for us to know that there is that support there. I also wanted to let people know, too, that we have the Amy Breeze Harper Show archived on our website, animalvoices.ca. You can check it out there, download any of the 300-plus shows that we currently have archived on that site. And also, we have next week all lined up, and we're going to be speaking with PhD candidate Carol Glasser about her very interesting work in the area of militant direct action in the animal liberation and rights movements. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Steve, who will tell us more about this controversial act in the United States.
First, I'm going to read a couple of news articles. So we got two stories today. First one's coming to us from the Wall Street Journal. It reads, right to hunt fish on ballot in four U.S. states. Worried that their pastime might get waylaid by a growing animal welfare movement, U.S. hunters and anglers in some states are seeking constitutional safeguards. When voters in Arizona, Arkansas, South Carolina, and Tennessee go to the polls to cast their ballots in the congressional elections on November 2nd, they will also be asked if they support making hunting and fishing constitutional rights. That will be a loaded question at that time of year, when deer season is starting in many states and millions of Americans take to the woods, firearms in hand. Quote, when you have something protected in your Constitution, then it's very difficult to use the courts or other types of ballot activities to thwart, for example, hunting and fishing, said Steve Ferris, a Democratic Arkansas state senator and the bill's lead sponsor there. Quote, they start with cats and dogs, and the next thing you know, someone says it's inhumane to shoot a deer. It's like buying an insurance policy, he told Reuters in a phone interview. According to the National Conference of State Legislators, 10 states guarantee the right to hunt and fish in their constitutions. Vermont's provisions go back to 1977, but the rest have all been put in place since 1996. The current measures are not seen making a big difference in any of the House or Senate races. But they are another lifestyle clash in America's many culture wars, which often seem to pit the rural and conservative heartland against urban liberals. The current drive to give hunting and fishing added protection also comes against the background of data that suggests a decline in such activities. According to one widely cited report by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 12.5 million Americans hunted in 2006, down 4% from 2001 and 11% in 1991. The number of anglers from 1991 to 2006 fell 16% to 30 million. A desperate attempt to prop up a dying pastime was how Ashley Byrne, a New York-based campaigner for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, described the hunting and fishing ballot proposals. She said PETA had not mounted any campaigns against the amendments, but said it would continue to educate people about how hunting is cruel and unnecessary. But for many Americans, it is a cherished way of life, and the divide between the PETA view of hunting and that of Mike Adams, 60, a builder from Brisby in southern Arizona, could hardly be starker. He bought his first rifle when he was 9 years old and has hunted ever since. He's preparing for an annual deer hunting trip with a dozen buddies later this month, and backs Proposition 109, which he feels would enshrine rights in Arizona that he sees as under attack. I feel that if some animal rights activists are going to extremes to take our right away to both bear arms and to bag game, said Adams, who hopes to harvest some elusive white-tailed deer in mountains close to the Mexico border. Quote, I'm a firm believer that anyone who wants to hunt should be able to do it, regardless, he said. Our second article is coming to us from the Financial Post, and it reads, Judge fines Syncrude $3.2 million over duck deaths. An Alberta judge has accepted a $3.2 million creative sentence for Syncrude Canada Limited on charges stemming from the deaths of more than 1,600 ducks on one of its oil sands waste pond 2 years ago. The oil company must pay an $800,000 fine by November 1st under the sentence, which will also promote avian research, wildlife monitoring, and habitat conservation. The sentence proposal, which was 2 months in the making, was submitted in St. Albert Provincial Court as lawyers for the oil sands giant apologized for the company's failure to prevent the deaths of waterfowl on April 28, 2008, at Syncrude's 12-kilometer settling basin north of Fort McMurray, Alberta. The incident had made international headlines as photos of oil-drenched ducks fueled opposition to oil sands development and the calls for bans on synthetic crude. Syncrude lawyer Ron Krulak said the oil company accepts the responsibility for the incident and believes the penalty is reasonable. Quote, It was Syncrude's obligation to ensure that it had a program in place to protect waterfowl, he said. Federal and provincial Crown prosecutors told provincial court Judge Ken Tosvold that the creative sentencing program will direct $1.3 million to an avian research bird deterrent program, $250,000 to wildlife monitoring training at Fort McMurray's Keanu College, and $900,000 for the purchase of 1,500 acres of waterfowl habitat near North Cooking Lake, east of Edmonton. Syncrude could have faced fines of up to $500,000 under provincial legislation and $300,000 under federal legislation, as well as a maximum jail term of 6 months. Federal Crown lawyer Kent Brown said he didn't intend to seek a jail sentence for company executives, but earlier suggested that after Syncrude's June 25th conviction, that he could ask for a maximum fine for each of the 1,600 birds that perished. At a trial that stretched more than 8 weeks, prosecutors argued Syncrude failed to prevent birds from landing on the Aurora tailing pond because it didn't put out the bird deterrent cannons and effigies in advance of the spring migration, even though company employees warned that the ducks had started to arrive. Syncrude argued that the region had been hit by the second heaviest snowfall in 60 years. It claimed its employees could not have been reasonably expected to deploy duck deterrents around the toxic tailing basin. The judge found in June that Syncrude's bird deterrent team was understaffed and ill-equipped to place the cannons around and on the settling basin. Other oil sands companies had bird deterrent systems operating even before Syncrude called in its seasonal bird and ecology team. And that's all the news we have for today. We're going to be joined later in the program by Barbara Schmitz. She's the Missouri State Director for the Humane Society of the United States, and she's organizing a campaign around Prop B, which, as Lauren mentioned earlier, is the Puppy Mill Cruelty
Prevention Act.
Prevention Act, a piece of legislation that they've proposed for the ballot coming up next week. And I don't know, I mean, we got our finger crossed that it passes, but we know that in the past, legislation like this hasn't really been too effective.
Yeah, I always have Gary Francione sitting on my shoulder now saying, the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. So will it actually end up meaning anything? Will it actually be enforced? Will it actually have people there that are going to oversee this, or will there be just tons of loopholes? Mm-hmm. So we'll get into the ins and outs. I think there's been some valid criticisms raised. There's all sorts of exceptions that are put forward with the Prop B. So it sounds like a good potential act, but you know, we have, I think hunters breeding dogs are exempted strangely from the act.
Mm-hmm. This is something that we'll hopefully be able to question Barbara about and find out more about why exactly they've been exempted, and maybe find out some more details about the proposition in general.
Yeah, it should be a good interview. I should let people know, again, if you would like to check out this show as an archive program, as a podcast, you can always go to our website, animalvoices.ca. The show will be archived within about a week or so. And we also have all of the 300-plus shows archived on that site as well. Are we getting close to 400 now?
I think we are, yeah.
Wow. Amazing. And that's really only still a partial archive, because when the show started in 1996, it was still in the time of cassettes. I remember when Najda and I came on in 2000 that we were saying to each other, maybe we should record the show sometimes. We would bring in these cassettes and sometimes they'd get eaten or sometimes the recording wouldn't happen properly. So anyway, the show's been on the air for a really long time, and that's only a partial archive that we have on the website. So again, check out the website. All those shows are free to download. And also, if you have any ideas for upcoming programs, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. com. I think we're going to go to some Arcade Fire.
That's right. We're going to jump forward in time. We're going to go from the time of cassettes to playing some music off of a laptop here.
Great. And this is a song called Ready to Start, one of my favorite tracks from the new album, The Suburbs, Arcade Fire.
We are back on Animal Voices. We have Barbara Schmidt on the phone. I'm just going to read a brief introduction that I got off the HSUS website for our listeners that maybe haven't heard of your campaign or haven't heard of you, actually. So Barbara Schmitz is Missouri State Director for the Humane Society of the United States. Since 1992, she has pursued pro-animal legislation at the state and federal levels. She graduated from law school in 1993 and obtained her license to practice law in 1994 while working on poverty law issues. A former director of volunteer programs at the Humane Society of Missouri, Schmitz has acted as state coordinator for the Humane Activist Network from 1999 until 2004. She served on the board of directors for the Missouri State Otter Protection Coalition, the St. Louis Animal Rights Team, and for court-appointed special advocates. Schmitz chaired the steering committee and also managed the campaign for Missourians Against Cockfighting, the first statewide citizens initiative on animal protection issue in Missouri. The campaign gathered more than 135,000 signatures to qualify for the 1998 ballot and passed in a landslide vote. From 2004 until 2009, Schmitz has advocated for animal protection legislation for Born Free USA, focusing primarily on state laws protecting animals in pet shops and animals caught in body-gripping traps. She also supports other animal-related child protection and social justice organizations. She's now in the midst of a campaign in Missouri to shut down the estimated 3,000 puppy mills, a full 30% of the total estimated puppy mills in the United States, through Proposition B. She joins us from her campaign office in Missouri. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks so much.
I hope that intro wasn't too bad. I'm guessing maybe you wrote that back in the day.
A long time ago.
Well, it definitely speaks to your accomplishments. Before we get into talking about Prop B, I was wondering if you could tell some of our listeners about yourself. About maybe the work you did with Born for USA, this animal advocacy group based in California. Could you tell us more about your work with them?
Certainly. I ended up accidentally becoming a lobbyist for animal protection issues. I eventually started out as a volunteer going to the state capitol in the state where I lived years ago, and it was Missouri. And that sort of lobbying effort ended up taking over my career. And I worked for the Animal Protection Institute, which is also known as Born Free USA, and essentially just went to the state capitol in California, also went to other state capitals, and tried to advocate for animal welfare improvements. It brought me into contact with a lot of people who had different opinions than my own and obviously required working to persuade legislators and lawmakers to, you know, sort of change the rules.
Your current campaign is organized against puppy mills in Missouri. Can you tell us what a puppy mill is?
Yes. Unfortunately, it's a rampant problem here in Missouri. We have large-scale dog breeding facilities that treat the dogs as cash crops. And the conditions at some of these facilities are pretty substandard. Some of the facilities end up cramming dogs into small cages. The cages can have wire flooring on the bottoms, mm-hmm. So that dogs never are able to actually stand on solid ground. They never are able to run through the grass or play. The dogs at these facilities are not allowed exercise. They're not given veterinary care, even if they're sick or injured. Some of them suffer enormously from ongoing medical issues that go untreated. Others end up dying. And all of this is done for the sake of producing as many puppies as possible for sale.
Now, I imagine you've probably been to some of these puppy mills. Could you describe for our listeners exactly what they might see if they were walking into one of these facilities?
Well, the things that you tend to see time and again at the facilities that have substandard care for the dogs, first of all, the first sense that impacts you tends to be the smell. Some of the dogs have not been kept in sanitary conditions. Some of them are sick or injured, and so the smell typically is a problem. The dogs often are in little cages that you might think of as being chicken coop wire or small boxes, roughly a 2x2 size cage. And you may have one dog that lives in that cage, or you may have multiple dogs in that cage. The cages can be elevated off the ground, and so they're literally composed entirely of wire that's elevated up, so that waste falls through and hits the ground. The dogs are often eager to see people. They tend to react in one of two ways. They're either eager to see people and seek a great deal of attention because they're lonely and they're pack animals, or they're fearful and completely unsocialized. But the conditions that the dogs in some of these facilities live under are pretty much inhumane, and it's something that the average person really can't conceive of because we're usually so close to our dogs and we treat our dogs like members of the family.
Yeah, this is Lauren here, also co-hosting with Steve. One of the things that's so heartbreaking about this, I think, is what it implies also for doing work for other animal issues as well. So often when I'm teaching, people will say, in regards to animals and agriculture, you know, we wouldn't stand for this if this were dogs or cats. And you look at how dogs are treated in these sorts of facilities, and I'm left with just a feeling of, how did we get here? You know, these are the animals that culturally anyway, North America, are prized as being pets, people's best friends. How did we get to such extreme conditions, such levels of cruelty with dogs, that animals really that we consider to be so close to us and we recognize as having personalities and that kind of thing?
That's a really good question, Lauren. I think that it happens because several different factors have all come together. The first is that we have weak laws here in Missouri. And so you have individuals who are able to take advantage of those weak laws. And some of those individuals just don't have a heart to care for the dogs the way that a lot of us believe that they should. You also have a profit incentive. You know, when you have weak laws and that is combined with the incentive to make more money by cutting corners, some folks will end up cutting the wrong corners and the animals end up suffering. And I think that at some point you end up with an industry that finds that it has a safe haven, and people tend to congregate there because they do believe that it's okay to treat dogs this way and it's okay to make a profit however you can. And so we may have had an industry that took root here several decades ago, but it has certainly flourished because nothing has kept it in check. There's been no counterbalance to the incentive for profit. And it's just very sad. This has been a problem for years.
I was wondering what your campaign is proposing this proposition be. What would that do to regulate or shut down these poppy mills?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. I was actually drawn into the animal welfare movement 18 years ago because of the puppy mill situation here in Missouri. And during that period of time, the situation has not improved, and it probably has gotten worse. And that's because the existing laws, which do date back to 1992, are weak, they're vague, and they have a great deal of loopholes, and they just haven't been improved on in nearly two decades. So Proposition B will fill the gap that we have in existing laws. We're creating the crime of puppy mill cruelty, and we're setting out very clear standards, and those standards will reach into the most common abuses that we see at the large-scale facilities here. By setting out clear standards, we will be able to ensure that the dogs at large-scale breeding facilities are able to be treated properly and actually are treated properly. And there will be a misdemeanor penalty for those who decide not to comply with the law.
So what are the specifics then of these standards that are being proposed?
First of all, we are addressing the problems with the caging. We are requiring that the dogs have more space than they're allowed under existing law. Under existing law, if you have about 6 inches in front of a dog's nose here in Missouri, that's considered adequate. The reality is that's not adequate. That's inhumane. So we are expanding the amount of space that the dogs will have. In addition, we are getting rid of the wire flooring. And so the dogs will no longer have to suffer foot and leg injuries after living on wire flooring their whole lives. They will end up with cages that have solid bottoms, so that's going to protect them. We're also requiring that they have exercise. Under our measure, they would have unfettered access to an exercise area. In addition, if the dogs are sick or injured, they would receive veterinary care. That's huge. You know, there's so many times where you see dogs that have just been in these facilities suffering untreated, and that's just not acceptable. We're also going to mandate that the dogs not be bred every single cycle. In the facilities here that do the high-volume breeding, the female dogs end up depleted at the age of 5 or 6, and it's because they've been bred every single cycle with no rest or relief. that combined with the inadequate veterinary care translates into significant problems for many of these dogs. So that's going to be remedied by requiring that the dogs be given a rest between breeding cycles. And finally, we're going to require that if the dogs are going to be euthanized, that it's done humanely. Here in Missouri, unfortunately, one of the big gaps in our law is that there is nothing that really mandates that if a large-scale dog breeding facility is going to put a dog to death, that they do so humanely. And there are routine examples and reports to me of pretty horrendous things happening to these dogs after they've given their entire lives to produce puppies. And we're trying to remedy the worst abuses.
Okay, so just, again, just back up for us a little bit. So there's different sets of dogs then that are involved in the industry. You have the female dogs that are the breeders. I assume you also then are having stud dogs being brought in, or they're also on the premises. And then you have the puppies, and how long are they there for? And can you just remind me again of the numbers that we're talking about in Missouri?
Certainly. The best estimates are that we have about 3,000 puppy mills here in Missouri, and that's by far the largest number of any other state in the country. And if you take the three next states behind Missouri and combine their numbers, you end up with about 3,000 mills. So we are the puppy mill capital of the country. The best estimate also is that there are about 200,000 breeding dogs that are kept in these facilities in Missouri, and that they're churning out literally hundreds of thousands of puppies a year. Those puppies are being shipped and transported all over the country. There's a pipeline from Missouri to California, to Florida, Texas, New York, the farthest reaches of the country.
Are these dogs ending up at pet stores, or where are the dogs going?
Yes, the most frequent places for these puppies are for sale in the pet trade. And so if you go into a pet shop anywhere here in the country and you want to purchase a puppy, the chances are very high that you're purchasing a puppy from Missouri, from one state out of the 50. And that can be as much as a 30 to 40% chance of any pet store in the country having a puppy from Missouri. In addition, the puppy millers are also selling puppies over the internet. And so consumers will go on the internet, they see a beautiful website, they talk to the person by phone or by email, and the person may say and do all the right things and may sound very reassuring, but the reality is that if you are purchasing a puppy online, the chances are very high you're dealing with a puppy mill. Good breeders do not want to sell their puppies in pet stores. Good breeders do not want to sell their puppies online, and the reason for that is very simple. Good breeders want to know that the person who's buying their puppy will take care of that puppy the rest of his or her life. They don't want to see puppies end up in inappropriate places. And so that means that they want to meet you, the prospective buyer, and they want to make sure that everything is okay. And if you have somebody who is handing over their puppies and shipping them out across the country, sight unseen, that's a huge red flag, huge red flag. So there's definitely a consumer education component in this. But with Proposition B, we're trying to attack the problem right at the heart of the matter. We're trying to go right to the places where those puppies are being bred, and we're trying to take care of those mom-and-pop dogs.
Barbara, we have to take a quick station ID and a quick musical break, but we're going to return with you in a minute, and I really wanted to talk with you about the response that you've gotten from Missourians, especially from people who are opposed to this proposition. I know they've organized a pretty large campaign as well under the auspicious name The Alliance for Truth. And I wanted to talk with you about what, you know, you think of their campaign, their counter campaign, and especially their ties to Tea Party representatives like Joe the Plumber, for instance. So we're going to return with you in just a couple minutes. Please stay on the line.
Gladly.
Hi, and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with co-host Steve Romanen, who's also teching for us today. And we also have Teresa here, too. I always want to thank her because she's been coming in and helping us with the teching as well. And I had her in mind when I was picking the music today. This was Parallel that we just heard at the break. That was a song called Old Notes from her new album, Fog Like This. It's absolutely beautiful. I would definitely suggest people check out Parallel. We're speaking today with a representative from HSUS about Prop B, which is the Puppy Mill Cruelty Prevention Act, and I'll turn it back over to Steve. I know you were interested in some of the critiques of Prop B.
Sure. Barbara, I was wondering, what has been the response of the citizens of Missouri to this campaign so far?
Well, we've had an overwhelmingly positive response. We set out to gather about 135,000 signatures from Missourians across the state in 14 weeks. And to my knowledge, there's been no other ballot measure for animal protection that has had only 14 weeks to gather the signatures. We ended up blowing through those numbers, and we ended up with 190,000 signatures from registered voters. Literally, individuals were calling the Secretary of State's office asking where they could find out how to sign our petition. And I don't think that's ever happened before either here in Missouri. So we had a very positive response. We think that Missourians are ready for this change. I think that we're probably all tired of turning on the evening news and seeing large numbers of dogs that are in terrible shape coming out of some of these facilities. So it's time to remedy it.
And what about there? I know there has been some opposition to this campaign. Would you be able to speak about that as well?
Oh, certainly. I'm actually a little bit reassured that we have opposition because if everybody agreed with us, then I would perceive that the effort was really useless and wasn't going to have an impact for the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have definitely had opposition to our measure. And with 7 days left before the election, we're definitely not taking anything for granted. We're working very hard to get the message out and make sure that this measure passes.
Yeah, when I first heard about the campaign and saw some news articles about it, it seemed like the opposition was all coming from sort of a radical right-wing group, and they had ties to the Tea Party, this Alliance for Truth. When it started to sort of, you know, when there were breeders coming up against this, and it seemed like the more maybe rational public was cluing in and saying that they were opposed to it, that's when I sort of got interested. It seemed like, okay, well, if they're concerned, then maybe this is legislation that has teeth. Would you be able to speak about the Alliance for Truth as well?
Well, I'm happy to respond to whatever questions you have. I have interacted with some of the folks who represent the Alliance for Truth and can, you know, respond to arguments and that sort of thing.
They're afraid that it's going to hurt legitimate breeders is what they're saying. Part of their arguments, and there's a lot of rhetoric, this notion people coming in from outside Missouri and you're forcing your beliefs on this and we don't like outsiders telling us what to do, and this notion that it's the radical animal rights wing out there and that this is the beginning of a slippery slope to ban all animal use, et cetera, et cetera. That's some of the rhetoric that they're using.
Well, when I listen to the opposition's arguments, the theme that I see is dual. The first part of it is that there tend to be scare tactics involved. And the second part of it is that the opposition tends to talk about everything except one thing, and that's the care of these dogs. And that's what this really is about. And I think that it's very hard to defend animal cruelty, and I don't think that these folks necessarily are trying to do that. I think that they're just willing to get out there and argue about a lot of other sort of extraneous issues. The reality is that this is a measure that is geared toward dealing with the care of dogs in large-scale breeding facilities. That's what this is about, that and nothing else. There is no other agenda. There are no other plans to do anything. And if the care of dogs is considered to be extreme, then I'm really not sure what to say to that. What we're asking for seems very modest to me.
It really gets positioned as an infringement on property rights, which I think speaks to the underlying problem too, but maybe you could respond to that, this notion that it's somehow taking away their liberty.
Well, I think that if you've been making money on cutting corners and sacrificing humane, decent care of dogs for a number of years, perhaps you feel entitled to continue doing so. But the reality is that there is no entitlement there. There's no constitutional right or other right to be cruel to animals. We have laws on the books that do address the most basic forms of cruelty, and unfortunately this industry has been able to flourish and exploit loopholes in the laws. We're going to close those loopholes.
Do you feel that the standards are far enough? Do you, in terms of what HSUS has been campaigning for and what you've outlined here, expanding space, getting rid of wire on the flooring, some enrichment around exercise, does this go far enough in your mind, or is this sort of a modest proposal in the beginning with the hope of strengthening it even further?
Well, I think that the standards that we lay out in this measure are modest, But the situation is so dire and so bad that even bringing us up to the modest level will make a massive difference. So I think that this measure is going to bring about significant change and is going to relieve a great deal of suffering. It's also going to transform this industry here in Missouri. It has to. We can't go on like this.
The one question I had, the only thing I really had a question about was there seems to be this sort of a hole in the proposed legislation for breeding hunting dogs. And I was wondering what's the reasoning behind that? Why was that left out of this measure?
Well, basically the measure addresses the breeding and sale of dogs as pets. And so we're focusing on the commercial industry that breeds dogs and sells them throughout the country as pets. There may be a minor sort of side industry of breeding hunting dogs for use as hunting, but that's not something that necessarily is going to fall in the same rubric as what we're talking about. Our focus really is the large-scale dog breeding facilities that we know as puppy mills, and they're churning out puppies that are for sale as pets.
One of the things I thought was interesting on the HSUS site, I believe, your organization talks about, it's really about strengthening the existing regulations. And of course, you point to some of the specifics as well. And one of the things that always concerns me about proposed acts is whether or not they will be enforced. And so are the existing regulations even being enforced? And then will these new regulations implied through the act, will they also be enforced? Like, will this just be something that will look good on paper? Will this actually make a meaningful difference for the dogs? Clearly, you think that it will. Can you tell us about the enforcement aspect of it?
Absolutely. We started with exactly that goal in mind. The goal was to avoid having a bunch of words on paper that were collecting dust someplace and didn't make a difference to these dogs. And so we started with enforcement in mind. And what Proposition B does is it does not tinker with the existing system of inspections and licensing. The problem is that the licensing scheme right now doesn't ensure animal welfare. And so we're setting up these standards, and we're also going to make sure that the standards are enforced because we're opening this up to having more local control over enforcement. And so we're creating the crime of puppy mill cruelty. And that will mean that local law enforcement officials will be able to get involved earlier in the process. Right now, unfortunately, local law enforcement is paralyzed by the existing regulations and rules, and it is left up to state inspectors alone to bear the burden of enforcing. They're caught up in a lot of administrative and regulatory issues. So by creating a crime, by creating clear standards and having a penalty assigned to that, it means that law enforcement will be able to get involved before it rises to the level of animal cruelty. For example, right now, you can call in a violation and, you know, explain that you have some concerns about how a facility is caring for the dogs. That doesn't necessarily mean that local law enforcement officials will be able to take action unless they're able to actually go to a separate side of the code that has to do with animal cruelty. And that requires all sorts of additional things to prove. Mm-hmm. Under our measure, it doesn't have to be cruel. We're trying to prevent it from deteriorating to that point in the first place.
Okay, that's interesting because that's one of the things that the opposition is saying. Well, we already have laws on the books that protect animals.
Yes, there are laws on the books. Those laws date back about 18 years. And those laws have significant loopholes. I think that the laws that are on the books now, they came from a framework with two aspects. One was, let's go ahead and get something really basic on the books and make sure that the dogs survive. Not that the dogs are treated humanely, but that they survive. And the second piece of it, I think, works from the assumption that the people who are operating these facilities are going to have the best of intentions. And so if you ignore the loopholes and you take the intent of the law and you use that as your guiding light, then you probably are going to treat the dogs well, but it's almost voluntary because of the loopholes and the vagueness. And that's where the problems lie. If you don't have those good intentions, if your intention is not to take care of the dogs, but your intention is to make profit, then you pretty much have free reign.
I'm concerned, too, when I hear about some of the standards that are proposed and just the interpretation, because law is so
often so much is left up to interpretation. So something like exercise that would be a requirement under these new standards, will that end up being as meaningless, though, potentially, as something like free run, where they might have access to a walk or to exercise, you know, maybe for 10 minutes, and that'll be enough to check off the box? I'm sensing from you that you don't feel like that they'll be able to interpret these new standards too broadly.
Yes, we've tried to make the standards modest but extremely clear. And that clarity will help the actual large-scale facilities themselves to know how to act so that they know they're in compliance. And it will also help enforcement because they will be able to go in and say either you're in compliance or you're not. So it'll be clear for everybody, and I think that's a good thing for all of us as well as the dogs. And so, for example, with the exercise component, yes, it's very hard to look at a dog and to say, well, this dog was exercised 10 minutes, you know, earlier today, or this dog is going to be let out of her cage later today. It's very hard to prove that one way or the other. We know after taking the dogs out of the cages and putting them on the ground and understanding that they have such serious foot and leg injuries that there's no way they can walk, you know, you kind of know it when you see it now. But that's a very different situation than having something be enforceable and being able to prove it. So under our measure, the opportunity for exercise is going to be there continuously. And that's because it will make it very easy to enforce, to make sure that people are complying. And second of all, that means that the dogs can choose. You know, if the dog is sleeping, he or she is not going to be pulled out of his cage, forced to walk, and then put back in the cage for the next, you know, 23 and a half hours. The dogs will be able to choose when they want to get exercise and when they don't, because they will have unfettered access to a small exercise area. So we were envisioning the same thing that you're identifying, and that is, how do you make sure that it's actually going to work? We want this to be a valid law. And a great deal of attention and negotiation was involved in drafting these provisions.
One of the things I was wondering, in terms of trying to eliminate some of the abuses that go on at puppy mills, or maybe eliminate puppy mills in general, does this legislation make it so expensive, so unprofitable, that these operations will either downscale their operations or just give up business altogether?
Great question. The intent was not to put these folks out of business. The intent was to make sure that the dogs are being treated humanely, and essentially to inject some humane standards and standards of care into the commercial equation. And so we were very cognizant of economics and the fiscal impact that might be out there on this measure. So we have a cap on the number of adult sexually intact breeding dogs at a particular facility. And so Proposition B will mean that you can have a maximum of 50 adult breeding dogs that produce puppies that you're selling as pets. And that's a very large number. That does not include the puppies. So that number will still allow facilities to breed hundreds of puppies a year, sell those puppies, and earn a very significant living compared to the average person here in Missouri. So we believe that the business is still very viable, but that the dogs will not be placed in the constant source of misery that they are now.
I know that we have a real range of different listeners to the Animal Voices radio program, and we have focused primarily in the show on animal rights and animal liberation as opposed to animal welfare. And I know that we're going to have some of our listeners say, what is the overall position of HSUS? Clearly, as you've just indicated, the point for this act is not to eliminate breeding overall. And I was just wondering if you could speak more specifically to, is HSUS eventually looking to see breeding phased out over a period of time, or is there a kind of legitimacy given to the industry itself that's profiting off owning and breeding dogs?
That's a great question. And I think that the Humane Society of the U.S. has struck a balance and has sort of a middle ground approach. And on the one hand, we recognize that there are too many dogs and cats and birds and other companion animals, and that there are animals that are ending up in shelters, are being euthanized now, and that this is a very serious problem. We are, you know, moving heaven and earth to try to help find solutions for that problem. At the same time, if you look far ahead in the future, to a point where that problem is being addressed, there will eventually not be enough animals at shelters to supply the demand, because there are people in our society who very much want to have a companion like a dog or a cat with them. And so the Humane Society does recognize that there are individuals who do take good care of their dogs or cats. They do breed them, and they do sell or place those dogs or cats with other people. And I think that there's just a general recognition that one day those folks will actually be supplying animals to people who could not otherwise have them. We're obviously very far from that point now.
So there's no fundamental opposition to the buying and selling or the breeding of dogs and selling them as property to people?
No, we don't have a position that is firmly opposed to that. We are not trying to ban all animal ownership. We're not trying to somehow cause the extinction of dogs and cats. Our approach is very much a middle ground approach, where we recognize that there are individuals who do want, for one reason or another, to have a dog or a cat that has certain characteristics. We also recognize that there right now are way too many dogs and cats, period, and that that is a crisis, and that's something that we need to be doing everything we can to solve.
I just had another short question here about how welfare legislation ends up impacting the public. And I'm wondering what your opinion on is on whether or not the sort of animal welfare legislation opens people up to moving towards maybe stricter regulations down the line, or does it just end up making people a bit complacent about participating in these industries?
I think it has the potential to do both. If you look, for instance, at what is happening here in Missouri right now, there are individuals in the puppy mill industry who very confidently point to a license that they've been issued from, for instance, the State Department of Agriculture, and they say, you can rely on me. I'm a great breeder. I'm not a puppy mill because I'm licensed by the state. And the truth is that that has absolutely no correlation to whether or not those dogs are being cared for humanely. But it is something that that individual can use as a marketing ploy to make consumers feel comfortable. And yes, once measures pass, a lot of folks, especially legislators, they can feel that, oh, I can check that off. That's been taken care of now. Let's move on to the next issue. And so I think it's very important to understand when you go into the public policy arena, you know, is your intent to have an incremental process where you are working towards a larger goal, or is your intent to take care of a problem once and for all and have, you know, this piece of legislation really address the problem in a serious way? I think you have to be very clear about that. And you also have to convey that. You know, if this is one piece of multiple bits of legislation that are going to come forward, be honest up front and let people know that. And on the other hand, if it is a situation where you really do want to just have everything addressed in one fell swoop, be very clear and honest about that and know where you can compromise and where you cannot, because the wrong compromise can end up harming the animals in the long run.
We're just down to the last few minutes of the interview, and I was wondering if there was any last words that you wanted to leave our listeners with, or a website that you wanted to plug, anything that you'd like to close the interview with.
Thanks, Lauren. Yes, we do have a website for the Proposition B campaign, and it's yesontheprop.b.com, and I invite listeners to check it out. I think that the main thing is just to let you know that we appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue. It's an important issue, and we very much hope that Missouri voters vote with an overwhelming yes on November 2nd.
Certainly one of the things that I've noticed teaching animal law at Brock University is that you look at the history of animal law, and that even when some of these various different initiatives weren't successful, that it really does help to start bring the issue into more public awareness and to initiate dialogue. So I appreciate the work on this, even if it doesn't end up going through. I'm assuming, though, you're feeling optimistic about it passing with that kind of support behind it.
Yes, we're very optimistic. We very much believe that Missouri voters understand the need for this and that they will support common sense legislation that requires decent treatment of dogs.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. That was Steve Romanen doing all the technical work for us today and organizing the show and co-hosting for me today. How did it feel, Steve?
It was a little stressful, but I think I'm getting the hang of it now.
It is stressful, but it's also hopefully fun. Hopefully you had a good time listening to it. For our listeners out there, if you have any questions or comments about this show or any ideas for upcoming programs, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. This show will be archived in about a week, animalvoices.ca. We have Teresa coming up with Raw Sugar, always a great show. And we're going to go out with one of my absolute favorite bands right now. This is a group called Helios. This is a song called 14 Drawings, and it's off the album Cesura. It's an absolutely devastatingly beautiful album. Please do check it out. And again, stay tuned for Raw Sugar on CIUT 89.5 FM.